This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Colonel James Tanner. Today is October 6, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Tanner is joining me by phone from Midwest City, Oklahoma. Is that correct, sir?
That's correct.
All right. Why don't we begin, if you could tell me a little bit of biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
Born in Emporia, Kansas, in November 7th, 1932.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My dad's name was Maynard Tanner. My mom was Beverly Pyatt.
Okay.
Dad was worked in the oil field in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, as a trucker, and then he went into World War II. And when he came out, he learned to fly fly airplanes in the military. And when he came out, he ran a fixed base operation for a while, and then he ended up back in the oil business for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Was basically stay-at-home mom and worked off and on and as a bookkeeper in sales barns and stuff around Kansas.
Yes, sir. All right. So did you grow up in Kansas then?
Yes.
Okay. All right. If you don't mind me asking, how did your family do in the Great Depression? And do you have any memories of it?
Well, I have my first memory is about 4 years old in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, when Dad was a pumper.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Plainville, Kansas. And both places I can remember wet sheets in the windows for the dust, keep the dust out.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff. But as far as not having a job, he always had a job.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So we did probably better than a lot.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, overall, what was growing up for you in Kansas like? What did you do as a kid?
Well, I basically, back in those days, there wasn't much to do except play. And my dad was overseas 2.5 years. We were back with my grandparents on my mom's side were. And kind of grew up in around little towns, and
mm-hmm.
I was I ended up wanting to play football, and then I had a heart murmur got sick with what they thought was polio, although they never
mm-hmm.
really diagnosed it. And for most of my high school years, I was not able to participate in sports, but I did end up valedictorian in my class in 1950, and went to was pretty normal growing up.
Yes, sir.
Childhood.
All right.
I spent most of my time, from about 13 on, at the airport where my dad was running a shop and fixed base operation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So is that where you got your interest in flying and in the military?
Grandfather on my mom's side had been in the Spanish-American War, and Dad had a brother that was in World War II, and
mm-hmm.
he was in his 30s when World War One. His brother was in World War One.
Okay.
Was in his 30s when World War II started, so when he enlisted, and they had a special program to teach people to fly, and then they flew light airplanes and spotted fire for the artillery,
mm-hmm.
kind of like later-day facts.
And, yes, sir.
And then, so I got kind of interested in it from that point of view. And then, when I went to college, I joined ROTC, Air Force ROTC. And somewhere about halfway through that, the Korean War ended, and if you didn't qualify physically for flight training, they booted you out of ROTC. So I managed to stay on.
Mm-hmm.
Got my commission.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, before we talk about that, I just want to ask you a little bit more about World War II. If you could talk about what you remember about the war, and if you talk a little bit about your dad's service.
Well, I remember two things. One thing that sticks out of my mind is the day that the war started, December 7th anyway, I had an uncle on my mom's side that had been drafted in the very first draft, I think 1940 it was.
Okay.
And so he was already in. That caused some consternation on everybody's part. And Dad ended up, after he got through his flight training at Hays, Kansas, and down at Fort Sill, he ended up attached to the 45th Division, which just happened to coincidentally be in the Oklahoma National Guard Division.
Okay.
That was called to active duty. And I remember us trying to figure out where to live, and we went to Virginia. Last stop before going overseas was at a place called Camp Pickett, Virginia, and we went out there for 6 months before he went over.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there 2.5. Let's see, he went 43. He was there about 2 years overseas, about 2 years.
Okay.
And came back. He went over as staff sergeant. That's what the light airplane flyers were when they got out of flight training, and then he got a battlefield commission over, was over there and ended up first lieutenant.
Mm, yes, sir.
When he came out, and he came back in August, let's see, late July, I guess, of 45, and was in group, was going to go to the Pacific, except the war ended, and they ended up mustering him out.
Mm-hmm.
He never went back to. So. That's about what I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. okay. Well, if we could talk a little bit about your education for a moment. Where did you go to high school?
I graduated from high school at Russell, Kansas.
Okay. All right.
1950.
Yes, sir. All right. Let's see. And then, where'd you say you went to college?
Went to got my bachelor's degree from Wichita State. It was at that time it was Wichita University. It was a city school, now it's a state school.
Yes, sir.
But I got a bachelor's degree in business after trying to be an aeronautical engineer, not liking it. So I ended up with a business degree and graduated in 1950, and then I later got a MBA from Auburn in 1975.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, let's see. During this time when you were going to college, the Korean War, of course, was going on. Had you paid close attention to that and I guess U.S. Politics in general as far as what was going on in the world?
Well, pretty much, I think. I wanted to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so another sidebar is I got married between my freshman and sophomore year in college.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the only way I was going to get to fly was to get a degree.
Yes, sir.
And I was aware of what was. I had several classmates, high school classmates, that actually were drafted for the Korean War. So I was pretty much aware of it, yes.
Yes, sir. All right. You mentioned being an ROTC. Was that a requirement there at Wichita State, or was it something that you just wanted to do?
No, it was elective.
Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about the ROTC program and what that was like for you?
Well, it was I never thought about it. Mainly what I thought about the program was that it was pretty good at giving you an orientation about what the military life was about. It wasn't since it was a regular class, and the only actually think it was once a week. I'm not sure. I can't remember now. But
mm-hmm.
Once or twice a week, and it having known a little bit about flying, didn't have anything to do with flying.
Mm-hmm.
It was all academics and stuff. So I thought it gave a pretty good background. And,
yes, sir.
For military duty, but didn't do much for wanting to be a flyer.
Mm-hmm. All right. And once you graduated, were you commissioned at that time?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
January of 55.
Yes, sir. Okay. So where did you, once you graduated and were commissioned, where did you go from there?
Well, I graduated in 55. There was about a 5-month period.
Mm-hmm.
Graduation and between commissioning and active duty.
Okay.
And I went to Malden, Missouri, which if you've talked to enough people, you probably know back in those days the basic training was done by private contractors.
Okay.
And the place that this particular contractor had was an old glider base in Malden, Missouri. Went there for 6 months for basic, and I'm sorry, for primary.
Mm-hmm.
Flew the Cub, and T-6, and was the last class there to fly a T-6, and they moved on to better airplanes. And then I left from Malden, I went to Vance Air Force Base in Eden, Oklahoma, for another 6 months for basic. Graduated there in, I think, June of 56 as a pilot.
Sir?
Again, it was the old airplane. This was a changeover time for the air military. And flew B-25s. That's what we were teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were in the process of switching over to T-33s and the jet basic when I got moved out again to another recip.
Mm-hmm. All right, sir. I wanted to ask you a little bit about this flight training. Now, what did you have to do to be qualified to get into flight training, or did everyone have that opportunity at first?
No, you had to basically pass a flight physical.
Okay.
And they gave you that. There was an air base at Wichita.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out there actually the first 2 years. ROTC was weren't committed to anything, and then you could go into junior years when you start picking up some commitments.
Okay.
Prior to the junior year to the air base at Wichita, and they gave you a regular flight physical.
Mm-hmm.
If you passed it, you were qualified for flight training, and if you didn't, you weren't. And then, depending on the quotas, but they weeded out enough people that practically everybody passed the flight physical.
Mm-hmm.
Got to go to pilot training. The 56 time was a drawdown because the Korean War was over by then.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not training as many pilots, so it's fairly competitive to get into pilot training.
Mm-hmm. Sir, all right. Could you give a little description of the training? I guess of say a typical day in basic flight training.
What phase?
I guess start off with from the beginning phase, I guess.
Well, primary, the routine was that you started out getting dual instruction.
Mm-hmm.
In the Cub, PA-18 Piper Cub, and then after about 8 hours, you soloed. And then from then on, you were about half solo and about half with an instructor where you practiced stalls and forced landings, and I'm not sure we did any acrobatics in Cub. It was a little mm-hmm. airplane. But, and then when you graduated, the Cub was about, I can't remember, 6 weeks of the primary, and then you went into the T-6.
Okay.
Where you did the full, again, it was a combination dual, and I don't know how many hours, but you flew the dual for a while until they soloed you, and then from then the rest of the program, you'd have a couple of duels where they teach you something, and then you go solo and go out and supposedly practice it.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on, and then he went through landings, learned to do that first, and then he did some instrument flying, and then he did some acrobatics, as much as you could do in a T-6,
mm-hmm.
loops, stimulants, and stuff like that. And then he went through an instrument phase, and in each one of those phases, you got graded. And plus, there was a full slate of academics. He went and flew half a day and went to school. Half a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and at the end of each phase, you moved on to the next one. And I think instruments was probably last. And then if you passed all that, you went on to basic.
Mm-hmm.
Where you actually, at the end of that primary, they split you up. Some of them went to fighters, and some of them went to multi-engine training.
Okay.
And, I went to multi-engine. That's where they told me to go, so that's where I went. And then B-25, you went through, again, went through the same series over the 4 or 6 month period, and landings, and then various maneuvers and stuff, and instrument flying, and you did it. Couldn't go solo under 25 because it was two pilot crew. But once you got to a certain point, they sent students out together by themselves rather than with an instructor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And at the end of that, they decided that I should stay there as instructor. So I went through an instructor upgrade
mm-hmm.
course there in B-25.
Yes, sir. All right. Was the transition between the single engine and the multi-engine, was there any difficulty there, or was it a fairly smooth transition for you?
No, it was pretty smooth. The T-6 was one of the hardest airplanes to fly, actually, to land. It wasn't much of a hand. It was a conventional gear, and B-25 was a tricycle gear where you set up the three wheels.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much easier to land that it made it, the whole process a lot easier. So I think it went from difficult to an easier
mm-hmm.
deal as far as just flying the airplane.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, overall, during this initial training that you had, did you feel that you were adjusting fairly well, I guess, to the military lifestyle and to being a pilot?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was doing okay. It came a period in it. I was an instructor there at Vance that I wanted to become a regular, but they declined to accept me for that, so I kept on as a reserve officer
mm-hmm.
all the way up until Vietnam, where after that they gave me a regular commission.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, so how long were you an instructor here, though?
I was an instructor at Vance from about 18 months.
Okay.
And then I went to, he had an early out, and I was about 3 weeks away from checking out in the jet when they ran short of people in Sacramento, California, flying T-29s, which was a Convair, same as the airliners used back in those days, the twin engine.
Okay.
And flying, training navigators. So a bunch of us were sent out there and checked out in a T-29, and then after being out there about a year, I became an instructor in T-29 also.
Okay. All right. Okay. And what did you do after that?
After the Mather?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, flying jobs were kind of hard to find, so I ended up. Transferred to after I spent almost 5 years there at Mather, which was nice length. I had a kid born in Malden, and I had one born in Enid, and another one born in Sacramento. We finally ended that string. But I was transferred to Anchorage, Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And the command post there, at that time we had fighters on alert at two bases in Turkey that had a nuclear mission.
Mm-hmm.
Command post there.
Mm-hmm.
Anchorage was a controlling facility for them.
Yes, sir. All right. How long did you spend there?
2.5 years.
2.5 years, okay. All right.
Terrible years.
Yes, sir.
For his family more than it was for them.
Sure. Yes, sir. What type of duties did you have there?
Well, the command post was set up like I guess all command posts ever that had that type of mission. You had a NCO and an officer, and you had nuclear release material in a safe, and if the word ever came down to send them, you had to open up that safe and make sure that the code word was right, and then you would send off the fighters. And that was the purpose of it. In actuality, what we did was a lot of planning and drank a lot of coffee.
Yes, sir. All right.
12-hour shifts. Got pretty long.
Yes, sir. All right. let's see. Okay. And timeline-wise, when is this as far as the what year? What year?
Turkey's tour was from 63 until it was, let's see, what part of 63? It was 2.5 years. It was from 63 till 65.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. And during this time in Turkey, had you heard much of anything about what was going on in Vietnam?
Yeah, that was one of the pluses of working at the command post. You got intelligence information from all over the world, so
mm-hmm.
I was pretty much aware of what was going on, and had decided that if I got a chance, I would probably volunteer to go join that fray, but I wasn't sure when that would come about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. After your 2.5 years in Turkey, was it to Vietnam for there, or did you have another assignment before?
No, I went from Turkey to Scott Air Force Base in Illinois.
Okay.
And we got there in December, I think, of 65.
Okay.
So, I wasn't real. Happy with the job I was doing, so I did then volunteer for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
A few months after I got there.
Yes.
Was accepted to go to 123 upgrade in Florida, and I did that in the summer of 66.
Okay.
And while I was there, are you familiar with the Ranch Hand Mission?
Yes, sir, vaguely, but could you talk a little bit about it for those who may listen to this?
Yeah, well, at that time, Ranch Hand, which was a defoliation mission,
mm-hmm.
using 123s and a 1,000-gallon tank in a troop-carrying space and spray booms. He flew it about 150 feet off the ground,
mm-hmm.
and a 1,000-gallon tank would last you about 4 minutes if you went straight. And anyway, it was a mission that kind of intrigued me, because I had, back in my high school days when I was working at the airport, I had done some flagging for sprayers,
mm-hmm.
and dusters out in western Kansas.
Okay.
So they had an opening for two volunteers when I got up through the, I was going through 123 upgrade, and so I volunteered for that, and was, since there was only two of us volunteered, there wasn't much, didn't have much of a choice. And then they sent me to the end of the 123 upgrade, which happened about August. They sent me to Langley for a few weeks. That they had an aerial spray flight there that they went around the country, usually spraying pesticides for mosquitoes and stuff.
Yes, sir.
And they were the training. That's where you went to get your training. And so I went there. I think it was 3 weeks. Wasn't very long. And then went back. My family had then moved to Russell. And I went to spend a week or two at Russell. And then went to San Francisco and got on a civilian airplane and flew to Johnson Hoot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Before we get into to Vietnam, if we could talk, if you could talk just a little bit for a moment about the C-123 transition, and if you could describe the plane and talk a little bit about that.
I had first while I was in Turkey, I had checked out in a T-39, which is a little twin engine jet transport.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I flew at SCOD also.
Okay.
And, but the 123 was a twin-engine NR-2800 engines, which was the same engine the T-29 had at Mather, so transition engine-wise was pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
It had been built, designed as a glider to be used in World War II, so the longitudinal members and the nose of the thing were pretty stout.
Mm-hmm.
Tricycle gear held was built as a troop carrier, having used as a troop carrier, and it was a full tank of herbicide and the and a full tank of fuel. The single engine rate of climb, which is always interesting to the pilot, losing the engine on takeoff, was a minus 150 foot a minute. So.
Mm.
Had a dump valve on the herbicide tank that you could get rid of the fluid pretty quick if you hurried, and so that was what they did to make it a little safer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was built as a twin engine transport, and it had high wing. R2800 was a very stout engine, but it was old. Even then, it was an old airplane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. I noticed that you mentioned in the questionnaire that you filled out, you mentioned that the C-123 was not necessarily the best aircraft for the mission you would be doing. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, the only problem with it is, it didn't have any. Filled it up with fluid and with fluids,
mm-hmm.
Fuel and herbicide. It didn't have any. If you lost an engine, you didn't have any. You were going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the stuff.
Yes, sir.
If you got the dump valve work and everything, it was okay. But it just didn't have a lot of power with a load. They later on put two small jet engines on it, which took care of that. They didn't. I didn't get to fly that model.
Okay.
And then, in addition to the recip, they added two small jet engines.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it a lot better airplane for the mission.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, as far as the spray training goes at Langley, could you talk a little bit more about it? And also, I noticed that you mentioned the questionnaire that it was not very realistic as far as preparing you for Vietnam. Could you elaborate a little bit on that as well?
Yeah. Maneuvers to spray a town with herbicide or not necessarily the best maneuvers to use if you're getting shot at.
Mm-hmm.
They say they would pull up and make a steep 92-7, turn 90 degrees one way and then 270 degrees back around and go back down on the target.
Mm-hmm.
Which left you highly vulnerable during that, that procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, he got used to flying it as a, he found out that it was a pretty stout airplane, but it, with the procedures that we used there, by the time I left Vietnam, we'd done away with almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. And the Air Force, I think, recognized that and changed the training quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. So this was a modification in the training, as for not the training, but a modification in the tactics that took place as you guys were on the job, basically?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
In fact, part of the, I don't know if I put it in my questionnaire, it's been so long. But one of the things I did, along with a couple of other guys over there, was write down those tactics in the manual.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whatever happened to it, but supposedly the Air Force was going to look at it and adopt it, maybe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, was there any other type of training? Was there any sort of, like, jungle survival training or escape and evasion training or anything like that?
No, I had gone through, before I went to Turkey, I had gone through the Air Force Survival School.
Okay.
And it was in the March, early April in the Sierra Nevadas, which snow up to your neck, so that wasn't very realistic as far as the jungle would go, but it,
mm-hmm.
the techniques for escape and evasion and those things were good.
Yes, sir.
And they did have a jungle survival school in the Philippines that some guys went to. For some reason or other, I didn't have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Timeline-wise, when were you sent to Vietnam?
September 66.
September 66, okay. What was your rank at that time?
Captain.
All right. Okay. What did your family think about you volunteering for Vietnam?
Upset with me when I volunteered until she found out what the mission I was going to do. She thought that actually I had a restriction on my I should not leave the States for 18 months after I came back because of the nuclear release information I had
mm-hmm.
handled. And she thought that it would be all right for me to volunteer because they wouldn't pick me for a while, but they had then ignored that because they sent me over right away. The only thing she was really upset about was volunteering for Ranch Hand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Uh-huh. And how did you feel about finally getting that assignment?
Well, you know, if you train, I'd been in the Air Force then for 10 years, a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're supposedly training to do, so I was happy with the assignment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. You said you came into country at Tonsonut?
Yes.
Okay. All right. What was your initial impressions of Vietnam, I guess, upon arrival?
Well, it looked like utter chaos to me.
Mm-hmm.
my first 6 weeks, we were based at, the squadron was based at Tonsonut, so we lived in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any barracks on the base there, so you live in hotels and stuff around town. And it was a lot different culturally. It was kind of a shock.
Mm-hmm.
Except I had been in Turkey, which also was culturally a shock, so I wasn't too surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's about what I figured. It was hot, and but everybody seemed to be happy with what they were doing, the mission they had, and everything. So mm-hmm. it was okay.
Yes, sir. All right. Was there, well, I guess, what was in processing like upon your arrival? Was there much of that?
Oh.
Okay.
I called the squadron when I landed, and they came, got me, and picked me up, and guess it must have done some in processing. It wasn't very, it didn't seem to bother me any because I don't remember it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. And you were assigned to the 12th Air Command Squadron?
Air Commando Squadron.
Air Commando, yes, sir. All right. Okay, could you, I guess, talk a little bit about the squadron and the makeup of it, and as well as the guys and the units. You don't have to use names if you don't want to, but if you could talk just a little bit about the makeup of the squadron.
Well, the squadron at that time was all volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had everybody from first lieutenants to majors. I think it was only lieutenant. Later on, we had a lieutenant colonel. When I got there, we didn't have any. Major was a squadron commander.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, a lieutenant colonel became. These were all guys that were basically frustrated fighter pilots. They came out of B-52s and tankers, and guys like me who were looking to do something,
mm-hmm.
do something that they thought they might like. And so they were a little, they were a rambunctious bunch, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all good pilots. Hard job, and they did a lot of hard work, and they partied hard.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. How many planes made up the squadron?
Well, I think when I got there were 9. They were shooting for 18, which is, I think, kind of a standard squadron configuration.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we ever got there. We lost 3 airplanes while I was there, and might have been up to 15 or 16 by the time I left.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And were they all C-123s?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And you said that the first 6 weeks you were based at Tonsonute?
Yes.
Okay. All right. What was the, I guess then the area of operations at that time was mostly around Saigon?
No. They kept a unit of flight, which was about a third of the guys up at Da Nang.
Okay.
And he rotated. He probably stayed two or 3 weeks in the Tonsonute area, and then he went up for a week or so. I can't remember how. Up at Da Nang, and then his flights rotated through there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I left Tonsonute, we went. Our base, home base, became Benoit.
Okay.
Where we operated out of, but we operated and I flew from the other guys did too, from all the way from DMZ in the north down to the Delta in the south. We sometimes had to fly a long time to get to target, but they used us all over the country.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. Before we get into the specifics of the operation, could you talk a little bit about Benoit and just kind of give a description of the base there?
Benoit was just a typical, basically typical Air Force base. It had been back to Tonsonute a minute. One of the reasons they
sure.
Us out of there is it was, of course, an international airport.
Mm-hmm.
Civilian traffic in and out. And they had us bivouac their airplanes, and our offices were in the same hangar as General Keyes' A-1 outfit, which was a key and eventually became president.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
This was his elite unit. So then when we moved to Benoit, it was more like we had a barracks, open,
mm-hmm.
open air barrack. Not open air, open sided. They had screens.
Okay.
Chow Hall and with Benoit was a fighter base. There was a F-100 wing there, and they were responsible for supporting our squadron because
mm-hmm.
they were the home tenant. They were the home base, home unit. And they did very well by us. They also flew cover for us a lot.
Okay.
We always had cover except for 1 month.
Hmm. Yes, sir. What types of planes did you say that was again?
F-100s,
okay.
And the same thing up at Da Nang. They flew F-4s up there. Yeah. It was F-4 wing up there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. So when almost any time when you went out on a mission, you had F-100 or F-4 cover?
Well, we had different kinds. We always had F-100s. Sometimes we had A-1s, which are a recip airplane. There were some A-1s to play coup. We went up to the middle of the country to come out and force. We had F-4s up at Da Nang. And a couple times, I think, we had B-57s, which were twin-engine bomber, but flew in from the Philippines and covered us. So the only time we didn't have cover was the month of October, and they decided to try us without it, and we took more hits that month than they ever had before, so they gave cover back to us.
Mm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Did the C-123s have any sort of defense weapons, or were you guys strictly spraying defoliants?
No, there were no weapons. It was all spray.
Okay. All right. Okay. Could you talk a little bit, I guess, about the standard tactics that you used, and I guess how they developed over time and work, and also working with the cover aircraft?
Well, we had some target. The landscape over there was the working how to protocol, I guess I'm trying to say. It was different depending on where you were spraying. We usually flew the target at 2,500 or 3,000 feet. We'd let down to 150 feet over the target. The target we usually flew with a FAC forward air controller as well as a fighter cover.
Mm-hmm.
And the FAC would mark the start of the spray run. And we always had a navigator on lead airplane that would confirm that. And that's where we'd start the spray. It was a known hot target, and we had Vietnamese permission. They would pre-strike the target area. They would run down strafing runs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If not, we'd have to get shot at before they could. The fighters could expend any ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
So usually we'd fly along the run. Sometimes it was a straight run. Sometimes you had to turn around two or three times, and the tank. Pump the spray out of the tank into the nozzles was set in the back of the airplane with a we had an enlisted guy back there running that pump.
Mm-hmm.
And when he get on target, he would tell him he'd turn on the spray, and he would watch the pump pressure and everything. And then if we got shot at, he had a bunch of smoke grenades with him, and he would pop one and throw it out the door,
mm-hmm.
hopefully. And then when we got done with our run, the fighters or the cover would go back and work that area over.
Mm-hmm.
So it depended on whether you were getting, because we had permission to strike ahead of time, or if you had to wait until you got shot at.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly you had to wait until you got shot at before the fighters could help you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
You could, and at 150 feet, you could hear when you got shot at.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And it was almost all small arms fire, up to 50 caliber. We didn't have to battle much any 57 millimeter or 37 millimeter any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A couple times maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was just small arms.
Yes, sir. All right. Well. Before talking a little bit more about that, could you talk a little bit about the, I guess, the different types of targets? Would they mostly be line of communications targets, or?
Our targets in the Delta down in the south of Vietnam were usually long canals.
Okay.
And to clear the area back from. Now, so the boats could go up and down
Okay.
Navy boats can come down. Also, there were special forces camps down there that were at the intersection of a couple of canals, and we'd spray around them. And so we were usually, and every now and then there was, they were getting ready for an operation or something, we'd spray, just flat spray jungle. And then in the north, it was primarily trails.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to uncover the Ho Chi Minh Trail up there.
Okay.
In Laos. And, I guess we can say it now, in Laos and where they came into Vietnam and down through the Astral Valley and on. And then we did some crop, had a different kind of Agent Orange was the primary herbicide, and we had a couple others that we used that would kill, or if we could find whether it could be a column or raising crop, rice primarily.
Mm-hmm.
We could kill that sometimes, try to get rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's mountains up in the north, and it was very interesting flying up there. You had to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. How effective do you think the chemicals were as far as defoliation, and how long would it generally take them to have an effect?
Well, it'd take maybe, first the jungle over there, if you're spraying just jungle, and we did spray a whole big area because they were going to run an operation through, and
mm-hmm.
it'd take 5 or 6 weeks, and then they would die, and then it would open up to another canopy underneath, and then you'd have to go kill that. So yeah, you had to plan these things quite a ways in ahead
mm-hmm.
ahead of time. And we all, but along the roads and along the canals and stuff, it killed them. It did a really good job, and it didn't take quite so long. If there was water around, it seemed to make the stuff get in the trees better.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We also sprayed along roads and stuff. The Army having trouble with ambushes, we could try to kill that stuff so they wouldn't. They'd have a little clear area anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Could you talk about, I guess, the different types of defoliants? I know there was Agent Orange, but what were some of the others?
Well, the only other two I know are Agent White and Purple, and they were both. Agent Orange is basically a broadleaf killer. It's kind of like 2,4-D killed. And the other two were more for grassy type things like rice and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's been so long, I don't remember the nomenclature. One of them was water-based, which meant you had to clean out the system if you're going to use it. The other one was oil-based like the Agent Orange was.
Mm-hmm.
But they were mainly used for crop plants that were grassy type plants rather than broadleaf.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did you primarily carry Agent Orange?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay.
When we were, we flew also some of those missions with the Vietnamese markings.
Okay.
They were politically sensitive, supposedly. When we did that, we had to carry a Vietnamese crew member.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be a Vietnamese presence on board. But we did that, I suppose, maybe 20% of the time or something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of working with the South Vietnamese, what was your impression of them?
Well, I thought that the South Vietnamese, the ones we dealt with primarily was district leaders who were lieutenant colonels in the Army.
Okay.
And these guys all seemed pretty sharp. I thought that the Army was okay. It just didn't have. They'd been fighting over there for 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were mostly tired. But I thought they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any problem with them.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I thought they did what they had to do in most cases to at least tell them end there, where they, I think they lost their backbone somewhere in that latter part when we pulled, after we pulled out. About that, I didn't have any. Their Air Force was very good. They didn't have very good airplanes, but they were. And that's who we did mainly dealt with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Those that flew with you guys on the missions where they would go, what was their role essentially?
The Phantom Agent flew with us.
Yes, sir.
It was just to have a Vietnamese presence on, because we had Vietnamese markings.
Okay.
They were usually, they started out with using pilots, and they thought the mission was too hazardous, so ended up using enlisted guys in the back.
Mm-hmm.
Back with the NCOs running the pumps.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So they would have some say-so in determining where the defoliants could be used and not be used then?
Not the guy on the airplane.
No. Okay. All right. But the Vietnamese on the ground.
Yes, they did.
Okay. All right. Like, for what, like sensitive areas, like close to villages and things like that, or...
Well, that could be true. They didn't want their crops bothered.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so we really worked for the Army, and the Army did all that negotiation with them.
Okay.
But the Army Chemical Corps guy was, when we'd go to district chief meetings and talk, they would talk about some of the things they wanted to do, and then, but they were basically trying to keep us away from their livelihood. And other than that, I don't think they cared too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, in a target area that you would be spraying, would it be cleared of friendly personnel? What would there?
We didn't usually, as far as I know, we never sprayed friendly personnel except in the special forces camps.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys wanted us to spray right up to the edge of their camp, so I would guess some of those got sprayed. But our mission didn't take us where there were friendly troops, and supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
There were not any to fly over and watch. Usually South Vietnamese, but I don't know if there was any effort to clear out an area or not. We sprayed so many places. I would say that there was some attempt, but I don't know that we ever knowingly sprayed over friendly forces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Except with the special forces guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you was, could you talk a little bit about a typical day, if there was such a thing, and what that would be like, kind of the daily routine.
We'd get up. The wind is a problem with the spray if you're trying to keep it within certain confines. So we'd get up and, in the morning, early, 3:30, 4:30, and try to take off. We'd go down to the squadron and have a briefing. Brief the mission. And we would maybe take off at 6 or 6:30. And sometimes you'd fly 20 minutes to the target, sometimes an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd spray, come back. Sometimes you'd go off for a second mission, and once in a while, even the third.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would sit down guys are going to lead the missions the next day with mission plan most of the rest of the day, and the rest of them went back and went to sleep, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time we'd already put in a pretty full day.
Mm-hmm. All You said a second or a third mission. Did that depend on things like... I guess what I'm asking is, did weather have an impact on...
Weather had some impact. Wind had a lot of impact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it mainly depended on. And then sometimes it got temperature had real high temperature had an impact on the airplane. So
okay.
So you... But I flew, for instance, 400-some missions.
Hmm. Wow.
That was in 365 days and some weather days and stuff, so get pretty busy.
Mm-hmm. So, essentially, if weather wasn't a factor, then you were flying every day?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Once in a while, you get a day off if you fought too many or had a particularly mm-hmm. bad mission or something, even the next day off. Basically flew every day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I noticed in the questionnaire that you mentioned that you were, in addition to just your typical pilot duties, you were also the standard eval officer. Could you talk a little bit about that and what those duties entail?
Well, I picked that up about halfway through my year there.
Okay.
An eval is a check section. There's somebody in the Air Force. In the Air Force, even though you were in combat, you had a certain number of check rides had to be flown.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two of us that gave those check flights there also. When a new guy came into the squadron, they had to fly some orientation missions, just ride in the jump seat, and they had to fly in the right seat
mm-hmm.
for a while, and we were monitored on that. Some of those had to be with an IP and some not. Basically, that was our duties, was making sure they were following standardized procedures pretty much, and then evaluate them every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
Not a very, weren't always popular.
Sure, a bit. Yes, sir. Did you find that most of them were following proper procedure? Were there, okay.
There were some... degree of saying this is war and we don't have to follow all the checklists and everything, but that got changed over time. People were pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm. For those guys who were having some problems, what would be done at that point?
Oh, you would mainly the squadron commander would have a visit with them, and then maybe an IP would fly with them for a time or two.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. All right. We've talked kind of in general terms about your experiences, but I wonder if you could talk about any specific flights or missions that kind of stand out in your mind, or the your first mission, if that stands out in your mind.
Well, the first mission. Right, you fly in a jump seat. You're watching over the shoulder of the pilot and co-pilot.
Okay.
And it was always a first time you got a hit on you had to buy the drinks that night.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy took 60 days before he ever got. He was a nervous wreck by the time he got his first hit. We were on target 45 seconds for the first. Heard the first hit on the airplane.
Mm.
That one stands out a little bit.
Sure.
That was on a mission over in Laos with a three-ship formation. We were number three. It was a mountain, another IP mission where they were, each airplane had an instructor on it. And we were getting some guys mountain time. And the
mm-hmm.
lead airplane went in, and that stands out. Lost five guys there. That stands out. And then my last mission is, I think, McNamara had decided they were going to have some kind of barrier from on the DMZ from the ocean to the mountains, and we were supposed to exfoliate the area for ways on the south side of the river that was, I can't remember the name of it, that was the demarcation line. The problem with it was in the range of North Vietnamese artillery, and they were scared that at 150 feet, an artillery shell on the ground could be kind of hazardous, just debris flying around. So we loaded up 10 airplanes and flew them up to the Marine base halfway up the coast, and then took off the next morning and snuck up there. And when we got there, there was a Marine fighter that was in our way. And we finally got lined up and flew 10 airplanes across that southern side of the DMZ and never got shot. Nobody didn't hear us. Round of any kind. But since that was my last mission, that kind of sticks in my mind. Plus the fact it was so secretive, and it must have really worked because nobody shot at us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. You mentioned earlier flying in a three-ship formation. Was that the typical formation, or did it just vary depending on the mission?
Varied. Three-ship was normal. It went up to maybe six. Three to six, I think, would be. I think three was pretty normal.
Mm-hmm. All right. I know you talked about the ship being hit 45 seconds into your first mission, but how often would your C-123 take fire, and how often would you come under fire?
Yeah, we came on fire probably, under fire probably between 50 and 75% of the time. Hits, I don't know, ended up with about 150, but they came one or two or three at a time. We had one guy that got 165 in one mission up. Caught in a flak trap that had been set for fighters that they had to. And that's a lot of holes in one side of the airplane. But mainly you would get just two or three at a time, one or two or three.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, I know you mentioned that it was primarily small arms fire. What type of damage could small arms fire do to the plane?
Well, we had some that would, control cables were, some hit control cables, and some hit, would hit the engines and had inverters and ran the instruments and could mess up the electrical system. We had a lot of them, the engine is most susceptible, and we had an awful lot of engines shot out with various problems. Oil coolers would be hit, but as far as physical damage to the airplane, it was mainly just holes that they'd patch, and but they could tear up things inside, could bouncing around inside. They would also sometimes hit the herbicide tank, and but basically mainly it would be engine damage. That was what happened most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, speaking along these lines, talk a little bit about the enemy and your impression of them as far as their abilities.
Force has different views of what abilities are than a guy on the ground, but
sure.
These trails that we would uncover for a while, they would. I thought they were very tenacious. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever stayed done. If you knocked something down, they'd rebuild it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. A lot of respect for them. They're also that much, didn't value life very much. And when you don't value life very much, you got a tough enemy.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding out in the Middle East right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Well, let's see. You mentioned also operating in Laos as well. About how many of your missions were over there in Laos?
Very small percentage. The Ho Chi Minh Trail
mm-hmm.
came down just on the other side of the Vietnam-Laos border.
Mm-hmm.
And probably most of our missions were on that. We're trying to uncover the trail there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, I would say, less than 5% of our missions were over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And would you, I guess let me ask it this way. Was the airspace over Laos more or less dangerous, would you say, or about the same?
For us, it was about the same.
Okay.
And we didn't get, we never did have much trouble with any aircraft-type weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They had a bunch of them over there because of the other airplanes, the fighters stuff had problems, but we never did. We had about the same ground people with ground fire.
Mm-hmm. Sir. All right. And would some of that, I'm sure you wouldn't necessarily know at the time that you're flying, but would some of that ground fire be coming from Pathet Lao as well as NVA? Or?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Okay.
Know.
All right. Yes, sir.
And we were there, but 66 to 67 is pretty early in the development of the war over there, and I think I'm sure things changed fairly drastically.
Mm-hmm.
But Laos was a brand new target and also very at the time highly classified.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I think that that became a little less classified and got a lot more emphasis after I left.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. One other thing I wanted to ask you, speaking along the lines of the Vietnamese, did you have much interaction with Vietnamese civilians?
No.
Okay.
We were at the airbase there at Ben Hoa. Was a Vietnamese airbase, and they were there.
Mm-hmm.
Families, Vietnamese families, the Air Force, Vietnamese Air Force guys lived on base too, but they were pretty well fenced off. They came in and did our laundry and cleaned up stuff and things. Some of the wives did. That's about the only contact we had.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
When they were in Saigon and Tonsonut, I think the guys had a lot more contact there.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't there long enough to.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Well, when you weren't on a mission and weren't planning a mission, when you did have some downtime, how would you spend it?
Well, laying around the barracks, there wasn't much to do.
Mm-hmm.
And people did a lot of reading. There were a lot of guys taking correspondence courses for various military, various schools,
mm-hmm.
Squadron officer school, command staff and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much a standard day, except probably did a little more drinking than during the time off than normal, but other than that, it was there wasn't much to do.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't flying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. did you ever participate in any civic action programs or anything like that?
No, but the squadron did.
Okay.
They had some tree planting. People out of the boonies into refugee camps, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept saying the one thing they missed was the trees, so we had an ongoing tree planting program, which everybody thought was a little ironic since we were out killing trees. But
sure.
But they had a couple other civic things, but our contact with the civilians was pretty limited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
Some barber that tried to break my neck every time he gave me a haircut. He was a civilian. Mm-hmm. I always accused him of being a Viet Cong.
Right. Now, your time spent on the ground, whether it be Bien Hoa or elsewhere, did the base ever come under mortar fire or anything like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Both places, Da Nang and Bien Hoa.
Mm-hmm.
But they never, when I was there, they didn't hit the part of the compound we were in. Shortly after I left, they hit, I saw pictures of the hooch that I was living in, actually, that had been hit. And it was at Bien Hoa and up in Da Nang. Some of the buildings got hit, but we never had anybody hurt from the mortar.
Mm-hmm.
Or other people were.
Mm-hmm.
I never lost anybody or got anybody wounded from it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, speaking along those terms, as far as the squadron goes, I guess I don't know the best way to ask this, but what was the casualty rate of the squadron?
Well, it was pretty high. We never we lost. While I was there, we lost 15 people,
mm-hmm.
which were in the Air Force unit. It was quite a few,
mm-hmm.
and we had probably the same number hit by either bullets or shrapnel flying or pieces of metal flying around in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Bullets. But and while I was there, we lost one guy. The pilot was shot and killed in the mission. Let's see, we had one airplane go down and everybody got off, got out of.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had two airplanes that one of them had three people on it, one of them had four people on it, one of them had five that crashed and there were no survivors. And then we had one crew, my standing eval crew, all except me, were going over to pick up an airplane and had some battle damage in another base. Hooked a ride with a cargo carrying 123, which crashed en route and killed them. So we lost quite a few people in different ways.
Sir.
We probably never had more than, let's see, 35 or 50 flyers involved. So it was a fairly high casualty rate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Another thing I wanted to ask you, you talked about sometimes when enemy bullets would hit the plane that it would hit the herbicide tank. Did you guys, that made me think, did you guys have much exposure to the herbicide itself?
Quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
The guy running the pump in the back had a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else had quite a bit. You would sometimes, when you were flying wing, you'd fly in another guy's spray. The area where they replenished the tanks was just pumps out of tank wagons that they pumped in there. There was a lot of exposure there. So
mm-hmm.
I think we had a fair amount. Some guys a lot. Some not quite so much, but
mm-hmm.
overall, the exposure came several ways.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, if you don't mind, I would like to ask you some of those some basic questions about Agent Orange, and if you or anyone had any adverse health effects as a result, and if I could get your opinion on the Agent Orange controversy.
Well, I'll start with the last one first.
Okay.
I think it's way overblown.
Okay.
Always have. I was, you know, I when I was flagging as a teenager in Central Kansas, 24D is one of the components of 245T, which is Agent Orange.
Okay.
Got exposed there, and then I've been part of the study. Started in 80, I think, somewhere in the early 80s, and quit 2002. They were 5 years. Mm-hmm. They brought 1,200 ranch handlers, which is about all there were, I think, and then a control group, and ran tests on them on us for 3-4 days.
Mm-hmm.
Really comprehensive. And they found a few things, but I don't, there's some diseases that they now claim are, could be Agent Orange related, but I'm not, you know, I don't know. I myself have got some, my feet are, now I'm up to my knees about, but I said I had diabetes, which is supposedly Agent Orange is a causative factor in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I tested my cholesterol and blood pressure and everything right up. Well, as soon as I got down, all the diabetes signs went away, but I still have my numb feet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was from the diabetes. I don't think it was from the, and I don't think it was from Agent Orange, but since they couldn't figure out what it was, I went ahead and applied for disability, and got, so I'm getting some disability from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a great believer in it. Hypocrite, but
why do you think that the controversy became what it did then? If it's overblown, why do you think it became that way?
Well, I'm not sure. The press had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
The GIs on the ground, you never could convince them that they hadn't been Agent Orange had caused them whatever was wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, not very many of them were sprayed with it, but a lot of them walked through areas where they had been sprayed, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very vocal in the veterans groups and getting that in the public eye. So I just think it was overblown. I think that they're probably the problem is it could be there. I don't think these people got enough exposure for it to cause the problems that they said it did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before moving on from Vietnam, are there any other memorable moments or anything like that that sticks out in your mind? I know you mentioned a couple of humorous moments in the questionnaire. You talked about something about a smoke grenade and
He didn't. I'm not sure which one that is. We had a guy that used the flares that some of the
mm-hmm.
airplanes used came in styrofoam boxes, and this guy boxed in his little cubicle and found an air conditioner somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Went to the air conditioner and put it up. And every week, somebody would set a smoke bomb underneath the intake on that. And the other problem we had with those smoke grenades is that if the guy in the back was throwing it out the door, didn't get it out the door. And since we're driving with both troop doors open and the windows up front open, flow of the smoke was always forward.
Mm.
So you'd get turned down and it ended up with everybody trying to get dodge the smoke. So we had that happen when we were down there.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably what I was referring to, one of those two cases. Probably
yes.
The air conditioning thing.
Yes, sir. Yeah. All right. You also mentioned as a memorable moment something about the unit being adopted by a monkey.
Hangar that we had there at Benoit we ended up with a monkey up in the rafters. Of course, it was open, wasn't he? And he or she, I'm not sure what it was, would come into our briefings or on the raft structure up above our heads while we're briefing sometimes, throw rocks, try to pee on somebody. I don't know if they tried, but it looked like that's what they were trying to do.
Right.
That all was kind of funny until they did it to the squadron commander. He decided we had to get rid of it, so we did.
Uh-huh.
He was, it was kind of entertaining.
Sure. Yes, sir.
He'd come running down from up above, and he'd come down the conduit on a light deal and grab hats off of guys and run back up. So took us several weeks to get him cornered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. I'm looking here. One other thing you mentioned. I'm not sure if this was a humorous moment or just a memorable moment, but you wrote something about you remember Christmas Eve at Ben Hoa pretty well.
Well, we always had a stand down. Always, I was with everyone. We had a stand down. And this one guy that had been kind of hiding when we moved from Thompson Dude. I think he had, anyway, he was hiding.
Mm-hmm.
And called him Pigpen because he did, like in a comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
And he also played a really good guitar, so we went Christmas caroling there. And went to the old fighter wing commander's door, and when he opened the door, he said, I figured it'd be you guys. He said nobody else would do it. It was kind of a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, are there, before moving on, any other memorable moments, anything else we should talk about?
No, I don't think so. It's pretty well. It was a really challenging mission. The flying part was pretty enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the rest of it wasn't, but
mm-hmm.
I was glad to get to go home when the time came.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. And when did your tour come to an end?
September 67.
September 67, all right. Was there any sort of out processing, or did the guys in the unit that were still there, did they do anything for you?
No.
Okay.
Everybody just left.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been the oldest, well, been there the longest by that time for probably 6 weeks or 2 months, and I kind of snuck off.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any going away parties.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, how long then before your tour ended did you stop flying, or did you fly all the way up to the end?
I stopped about 3 weeks before.
Okay. What did you do during those last 3 weeks?
I was primarily a mission planner.
Okay. All right.
Also finished writing up with that manual on the tactics I talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
I spent a lot of hours on downtime days working on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, upon leaving Vietnam, I know this may be a silly question, but how did you feel about leaving?
Well, I was glad to leave, and I could obviously tell there's still a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm. All right.
The guy that we had over there, my tour, that came back for a second tour, killed on his 500th mission, so I put a damper on people volunteering to come back, I think.
Sure.
Makes me think.
Sure.
I think it's just like any other thing. If you stay out long enough, sooner or later something bad's going to happen, so you just will. If you can get out while it's still getting out time, it's okay. You should do it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
That's why I'm upset that they're sending these guys now back 3 or 4 times. Bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, upon your leaving, how did you, you mentioned that there was still work to be done, but how did you feel that the war was going when you left?
Oh, I think that I thought it was pretty much stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 4 months before Ted.
Mm-hmm.
Good things happened to some bad things, but I didn't think we were losing it. I just thought it was going to take a lot longer than anybody thought to win it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, upon upon your arrival home, what type of reception did you receive?
Well, the family met me when I got off the airplane, and so we had a good reception.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seemed glad to see me.
Mm-hmm.
But driving around airports after that, as far as how the public saw you, got his uniform in uniform a couple of times, I got spit at,
stuff
like that. So the public reception wasn't very good.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
It was probably non-existent, I can see.
Yes, sir. Did you know anything, or had you heard anything about what to expect when you got back as far as the public's attitude towards the war at that point?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I got a letter from my wife about every day, and she kept me pretty well informed, but I was still surprised at how that changed over the year I was gone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. What was your reaction to, I guess, this negativity coming from the public and the unappreciation of the service?
That didn't make me very happy, but I had other stuff to do, so
mm-hmm.
I just kind of ignored it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, how much longer did you stay in the military after Vietnam? Did you have any time off before your next assignment?
Between Vietnam?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had probably, I don't remember how much, but my guess would be 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Mather, which was in Sacramento, and flew into Travis. And like I said, my wife and kids were there, and she'd already moved from Russell to the base and had everything all set up, so have any moving, have work to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we just kind of relaxed and enjoyed ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. What was your assignment at Mather this time?
Same thing as it's been before, flying navigators.
Okay.
Ended up on the standing bow team again.
Mm-hmm.
IP, flew as IP for instructor pilot for the time I was there, but I wasn't there very long this trip.
So how long were you here then?
Unless I got to Mather in September of 67, and I transferred to Randolph. And I'm trying to think, about a year later.
Okay.
Did this command standing bell team, which is went around and checked all the various bases.
Mm-hmm.
For a year and a half, and then I went to Armed Forces Staff College, which is a school for, by this time I'd made major and was also, I'd made, become a regular officer, so
mm-hmm.
went to Armed Forces Staff College, which is at Norfolk.
Yes, sir.
For 6 months. Germany.
Okay.
And Wiesbaden and Ramstein and 4 years over there as a staff officer on the Air Force Europe Command headquarters staff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Was Armed Forces Staff College, and was that is that designed to prepare you for this type of work and to make you for advancement for upper levels like lieutenant colonel and colonel?
Yes, that's what it was for.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
It was a joint school. It had Army, Navy, and Marines, and Air Force all there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. One thing, getting back to this time right after Vietnam for a moment, did you Was there any adjustment period getting back to more, I guess, life outside of a combat zone, or was it not a problem?
Yeah, there was some. I'd look out at night and see lights in the lower horizon, and for a minute think they went, but they were flares and stuff like that. I think that lasted probably for a year.
Mm-hmm.
6 months to a year for it. But basically, I adjusted pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Now, did you keep up with what was going on in the war fairly closely after you left, or no?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And as things like Tet happened and the Vietnamization and the beginning of American withdrawal happened, what did you think of that? What was your opinion of the way the war was going?
Well, obviously, it wasn't going very well. The Tet thing. I knew it were there and everything. This was misrepresented so much by the press that it caused a backlash here in the States that never stopped. But we practically actually won that battle, I think. But politicians got a little scared of it, and things went downhill from then. That was 68, so they had to put up with the less than full support, I think, for quite a while.
Yes, sir. All right. how about the eventual end and the fall of Saigon? What was your opinion of that? And,
well, basically broke your heart for those people and everything, plus the fact that it was something that probably didn't have to happen. We owed them more support than they got towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's making it.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that they weren't doing real well there on their own, but a little help might have changed the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
A little more help, I should say.
Yes, sir. All right. Where were you when this took place, when the war came to an end?
Germany.
Okay. All right. how much time did you spend there in Germany, you said?
Four years.
4 years. Okay.
Between Wiesbaden and Ramstein.
Right. Yes, sir. I know from talking to Army guys that were in Germany at that period, there was a lot of trouble with the Army, a lot of problems with racial issues and drugs and things like that. But was there, how was the Air Force faring at that time from what you could tell?
Well, I think that I don't think we had quite the problems that the Army did, but there were some problems. There was a standoff in a chow hall, and we had a base down in Italy that was so bad that they ran about three or four commanders down there trying to solve it, and finally got one that did. So we had had problems during that period.
Mm-hmm. Is this more racial problems?
Yes, primarily.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. How about in Vietnam? I meant to ask you about that. Were there any problems?
Not in our unit. I don't know. We had two or three black pilots, one of whom got killed in one of those crashes. We had a lot of black enlisted guys, and I don't think that I don't remember any problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And we're a small enough unit, I think everybody would have known.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay, so after 4 years in Germany, where did you go from there?
Came back to the Air War College.
Okay.
Montgomery, Alabama.
Yes, sir.
Another school that's supposed to get you ready for lieutenant colonel and colonel type, mainly colonel type jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there, actually was in Montgomery for 4 years, I guess, four and a half. And went through the school, and then I stayed there as instructor.
Okay.
So while I was there, I made lieutenant colonel in Germany, and I made actually made major in Vietnam, made lieutenant colonel in Germany, and then while I was in the staff at the War College, I made colonel.
Okay. As an instructor there, what were you teaching?
Well, I was in the leadership and management. They had different kind of teachings, different kind of curriculums.
Mm-hmm.
And one block would be leadership and management. Some of them would be tactics, although when they fly and take apart with planning and stuff. And I'm not sure. There are three or four different groups. I worked for a while in the correspondence group because they did have some correspondence courses that they gave for a year or two, and then I moved down to the regular college for two or three years.
Mm-hmm.
I was an instructor there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. And after you finished up there, where'd you go from at that point?
Well, I left there and came to Tinker Air Force Base, which is here in Midwest City.
Okay.
As a deputy base commander. And stayed here, did that for 2 years. And the base commander's job, the base commander left. Base commander is not, he's a guy that takes care of the base itself primarily, not the overall, not a normal base. Our overall commander is a wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes care of the flying part, and the base commander takes care of everything else. And so anyway, when the base commander here got transferred out and I didn't get his job, I asked to be moved. And after a couple of false starts, I ended up finished my career up at K.I. Sawyer in Michigan as base commander up there.
Okay.
Was there a year.
Yes, sir. All right. During this time, post Vietnam, these assignments that you have, did you continue to fly much, or were...
I flew not much, but I flew in Germany.
Okay.
And when I came back in 74, back to War College, and I never flew. Didn't fly after that again.
Mm-hmm.
No active flying.
Mm-hmm. Sir, what did you fly in Germany?
D-39s.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little twin jet. In the civilian world, it'd be called a business jet, but it held about six people, plus a couple of pilots.
Mm-hmm. Sir.
Really enjoyed it.
All right. Well, do you fly anymore today?
No.
Okay.
No, when I got out of the Air Force, I decided that it cost too much money and I wouldn't be able to fly enough to keep my proficiency up, so I've not flown since I got out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, upon your retirement from the Air Force, What do you do since then?
Well, I spent a year and a half as a station manager for a oil well perforating group that was actually owned by my wife's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And in 83, the oil bust came around, and so I ended up working for the state of Oklahoma in the mm-hmm. personnel business from 84 until 97. Time I got there, I was deputy director of the Office of Personnel Management for the state.
Okay.
And then I retired for good in 97.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before wrapping up the interview, last thing I'd like to do, it's okay, I'd like to just ask you some general questions to get your opinion on some issues involving the war, and for these you can just say as much or as little as you'd like. First of all, looking back on your experience in Vietnam, how do you feel about your own involvement in Vietnam and American involvement in Vietnam in general? What do you think of it?
Well, I'm not the guy that makes the big decisions. The government decided, the commander-in-chief decided that it was worth going in there, then I thought it was okay, and I thought initially it was, everything went pretty well, but it didn't last very long.
Mm-hmm.
I felt pretty good about my part in it.
Mm-hmm.
While I thought things overall went pretty good while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
All right. Along these lines, do you? I don't know. You said you know, the commander in chief sends you, you go. But do you feel that? Do you think that it was right for the U.S. to be involved in Vietnam or not?
Well, the political climate then, or worldwide, I think it was probably a legitimate thing to do. I don't know if today that same decision might be different, but Cold War was on and there was all kinds of theories, and I think it was the cause was okay when we started.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we got in there was okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. What you briefly touched on this earlier, but could you talk a little bit more about your opinion on the way the media handled the war?
Well, I think that they did the military a great disservice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody was trying to make their bones as a reporter, and I think that it grossly distorted practically everything that they reported on.
Mm-hmm. What's your opinion of U.S. policy towards Vietnam today and this relationship that we have with the Vietnamese government now?
Oh, I don't have any, you know, I guess if I was asked to vote on it, I'd say no, but I don't. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We've done it with other countries, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
It could be, I don't know. I don't agree with it necessarily, but it's not a deal with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not going back. They're going back here, so I don't care what they do.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. what do you think of U.S. Military actions or interventions since Vietnam? For example, Iraq and Afghanistan. What's your opinion on those, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I think that it's probably something that had to be done, but I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure who all is going to have access to this thing, but I think that anybody that thought we could reduce the armed forces by half while we're fighting two wars is crazy.
Yeah.
And I think it's caused us a great deal of grief.
Mm-hmm.
Individually in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cause was okay.
Yes, sir. Just a few more questions. How would you say what concerning Vietnam has had the most impact on your life, or has Vietnam had a major impact on your life?
Well, the impact would be life can be pretty short. You need to live it the best you can while you have it. About all, I don't think I had any lingering emotional or problems with it. I just think when you're in a place where people are dying around you, even if it changes your outlook on life a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Have you ever visited the wall? And if so, what did you think of it?
I think it's awesome, and I have visited it twice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before we wrap things up then, is there anything else you'd like to say about your experiences, or is there anything else we should cover that we didn't?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. Well, Colonel Tanner, thank you very much for your time. If you don't mind, I'll stop the recording and talk to you for just a few more minutes.
Okay.
All right.